You're listening to the Alex Wolf Podcast. Interesting conversations about innovation, economics, culture, and history for the independent thinkers and curious minds. I'm your host, Alex Wolf. Hello, hello. Thank you for tuning into this episode. We are going to talk about living life without a goal. Sounds a little depressing, I know. That's why we're going to talk about it. So the title of this episode is actually inspired by a book called Living Without a Goal. And it always gets people's attention when they come to my house. And literally the first thing they say is, that sounds depressing. And the whole irony of my point of view is that it might sound depressing, but according to what I'm seeing, if you look around, living life with a goal is what is depressing and actually depressing a lot of people. And so we're going to unpack that. We're going to talk about what I mean when I say that. I found this book in a bookstore in Oakland, California, when I used to live there, and I volunteered at this bookstore. And I just want to give a big shout out to all the used bookstores of the world, because there is no way I would have found this book any other way. It is on Amazon, but you know, I wouldn't have thought to search for this, right? This is something that found me, and I'm really glad I didn't find it on Amazon, because it has not the best reviews on there. And I think because the title just offends people to no end. And so I'm really happy I got to just experience the book on my own for my own interest and got to enjoy it. And I read it for the first time about 3 years ago, and I enjoyed it. But I also reread it again a few months ago, and it really hit this time as far as just the comprehension, and it gave me what I was looking for. It was a very, very satisfying experience. And I think it's awesome how sometimes when it comes to books and other things in life, that the first time you interact with it, it might not, you know, really satisfy you, but give it some time and get some experience and you can revisit it, and it can open up like a flower, like in a way you never thought possible, and satisfy you in a way you never thought possible, which I think is so just really reassuring when it comes to life, because that means that so many of the things we've tried for the first time might actually reawaken to us in the future. So that was my experience with this book, and it is written by a gentleman named James Ogilvie, and it's basically about his experience of trying to figure out the ultimate point of life, and it is written and articulated this like chase for meaning, the search for meaning, in one of the best ways I've seen it. Now, of course, this title attracted me because if you know me, you know that I really love the idea, not just the idea, I love the reality of living a life that isn't based on chasing external things, status, trophies, things like that, but a life that is more about sustaining a point of preservation is what I like to call it, which means that we are going in circles, literally, right? Like on the planet, we're going in multiple different circles. We're rotating, we're revolving. And so my whole like perspective about chasing is that there's no need to chase, because we're just going around and around and around. And it's about appreciating going around in circles instead of trying to think that, oh, if I go faster, you know, I'll get to the top. There's no top in a circle. And so that's been kind of the perspective I've been offering through, you know, these episodes and just through tech philosophy and in the world of entrepreneurship. A lot of it is based on trying to climb artificial matrixes of, again, some type of hierarchical, like top and bottom ideology that is completely based on on helpful illusions, but illusions ultimately, and how unfortunate it is that many of us are like pressuring ourselves to reach this top that doesn't really exist. And in the meantime, it comes at the cost of us ignoring the beauty of just being alive and going around in circles and enjoying each circle, each, you know, circle around the sun, which means like, you know, your year of life, each season, you know, and just trying to like sustain it so that each circle you go through or each time you go through this cycle, you can say, wow, I had a really good time. You know, there were some ups and some downs, and that's how cycles work. So he articulates the desire for this chase. And basically, a lot of Western ideology does not even comprehend the circle. It comprehends a line, again, a vertical line, or if you think about like the way we make our stocks, in the way we graph our stocks, in the charts we like to use, the most favorable line is the one that starts at the bottom and progressively rises, right? And that is how Western ideology kind of visualizes progress. And so it just wants to go up and up and up, and that's unsustainable. And nothing's really going up and up and up. And if it is, it's usually a sign that something is out of balance, whereas a circle means that it's going in balance. And so much of Eastern philosophy and ideology has been, you know, ancient Eastern, because now a lot of them have adopted our ideology, but in ancient times was about preserving just this cyclical movement of time and space going around and just appreciating it each time and each stage and each season that it offers. So he, James, is talking about how he tried to find the ultimate meaning of life through, you know, everything, through all the ways we try to do it. It might be through falling in love. He talks about that. He talks about how he pursued his career aggressively. He talked about how he kind of like dropped it all to study philosophy, which is another common thing that happens to people who question everything. And he also talks about how, you know, people who search for the meaning of life usually go to Buddhism. And he kind of shits on Buddhism, which I love, because he is being really honest about how there isn't this like squeaky clean answer about, you know, solving the mysteries of life, and how no matter how hard you try to articulate it or find that through doing these different types of things, a lot of the merit of the mystery of life is that it remains a mystery, and that ultimately one of the privileges of being human is that you can't outwit all of the mystery involved in the universe, and perhaps that is the point, right? That is the point. rather than thinking, you know, the point is to figure out through our very limited rationale system of like mathematics and science, which, you know, is helpful, but ultimately can't really stand up in the face of this vast universe. And maybe that's the point, right? So obviously I was super attracted to this title, and, you know, I just kind of laugh when people say, isn't that depressing? I don't know. I just feel like, yeah, it is. I think it is. When you are living a life that is surrounded about this big goal, then this type of topic can feel a little depressing or existential, but I'm not at that point, right? And I've lived enough of my years personally of like being so focused on that I can now enjoy this type of idea. So he opens this book up by talking about how living life without a goal is most similar to living what we would call an artful life or an artist's life, which means it serves no goal outside of itself. So he asks things like, you know, think of the foolishness of the question, what is the purpose of play? And that's, you know, that is about understanding how we don't question the point of play or the point of creativity, because it is an end of itself. It is not something we try to accumulate to get to another end. It is not a means to an end. The activity of listening to music or painting or dancing is not so you can finish up as quickly as possible, but to, it's the, you know, the very, those are very special activities in which you can be completely present, and that's the point, is to be present. It's not to try to get something at the end, to get a trophy at the end or something like that. And if it is, if you are in music to just get a trophy at the end, or if you are a painter just to get a trophy at the end, then it calls your commitment to this artistry into question, right? It's like, do you really love the art, or do you just, are you just trying to accomplish a certain status? So he says that when we live life without a goal, it has a similar pattern where we, and I've talked about this before too, how, you know, there's living life for life and there's living life for death. And many of us right now, I don't think realize it, but we live life for death when we are so obsessed with our legacy, when we are so obsessed with, you know, what we are going to leave behind or what we will accumulate. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that, unless it is coming at the cost of you not appreciating living life for life, which means, you know, just appreciating every day, every hour, you know, having something, you know, understanding that your life is kind of for rent, meaning like it's temporary. So yeah, one way to look at it is like, oh, well, you know, I should use this life to try to accumulate as many accomplishments as possible. But again, if those accomplishments are coming at the cost of you actually enjoying life, then how worth it could they be, right? So I think when people have the comment of like, oh, living life without a goal, that sounds depressing, it's because living life without a goal means that there is a space of purposelessness in life. Again, what he's saying is that, you know, if living life without a goal is the same as living an artful life, which means that it's an end of itself, it means that, yes, technically there is no quote unquote purpose. And that's where a lot of people freak out, because they're like, oh, that means there's no point of life. Well, there's a beautiful irony if you decide to, you know, step into it a little bit deeper and saying that if there is no purpose, if there isn't this accumulative pressure of building a legacy and all this stuff, not to say that, you know, you have to completely eradicate that, but if it isn't prioritized, then what actually happens is your life kind of bursts open with meaning, because now it doesn't have all this pressure and you can just appreciate things that you, you know, were probably taking advantage of before, or might have been taken advantage of before. And so that's the thing. It's like, it's a beautiful irony. Most people, they really feel like they have to burden their lives with all these goals and expectations for it to be meaningful. But what this type of perspective offers is, it's already meaningful. You don't have to, like, you don't have to do all that to make it special. It's special because you're here, and that's it, right? Very Disney Soul movie, if you saw that movie. That was the point. It was like, oh, you're alive. Like, that's pretty cool. Like, you don't gotta get a Nobel Peace Prize because that's the miracle, that you're here, and that you can just exist, right? But we live in a society where at this point, existing is not enough for most of us, and we have to do all this other stuff. So anyway, he explains the difference between goals with a big G and a little G, which I think is important. So when we're talking about living life without a goal, we don't mean, you know, oh, I have a goal to read like 30 minutes a day, or like, oh, I have a goal to like eat more fruit or something like that. We're talking about, those are, you know, those goals that I just said are goals with a little G. when he talks about goals with a big G, he's talking about wanting to like end world hunger, or wanting to end racism, or wanting to go to outer space and colonize Mars, or, you know, it could also be like wanting to win a Grammy or wanting to get a Nobel Peace Prize. It's not that these things are bad, y'all. That's not what I'm saying. It's just that there, I'm giving the distinction between big goals, you know, goals with a big G, and goals with a little G. And he argues that these goals with the big G are what makes people miserable, because they are often too vague and too broad. And it sucks because we've been conditioned to create goals with a big G in this culture, because we have made dreaming big here. We have made dreaming big as the righteous thing to do. So it is not only cool, it is almost morally necessary, right? If you want to be an upstanding citizen in this particular culture, certain Western cultures, there is a requirement that you better be dreaming big. You better be burdening yourself with some kind of huge mission-based big G goal, because if not, you will be, criticized. You will be seen as like, you know, who do you think you are? You don't have the right to just exist, right? A lot of ideology would see that as like an insult. And so this is coming from a very different perspective that says, actually, no, in my opinion, it's an insult to override the miraculousness of existence with being ideologically possessed about these big G goals, right? So it gets a little interesting. And he goes into different archetypes. He goes into like, you know, people who dedicate their whole lives to these missions, and then, you know, a few years in, they're burnt out. Like they realize that they have set themselves up for failure by burdening themselves with a super vague and, I want to say collectivist goal, but not just collectivist in the sense of like a few family members, but like collectivist as like huge bodies of people. And so it's really, really a good read for me, very interesting sociologically. And, he talks about, which I love this term, the vertigo of freedom. Ooh. That's what he calls it. And it's basically like, you know, this overwhelming feeling we have when we burden ourselves with these big G goals that, you know, it's, people think that, you know, if you have more options that it must be better, but you can get vertigo from having too many options and definitely too many like expectations of having these big G goals. Okay, so he offers goallessness is what he calls it. But, you know, again, this is like, to me, I read all this and it's the same thing as Zen to me. But whatever, we all use different terms to help us like comprehend. So he offers goallessness as an alternative way to find meaning in life. And I have a few quotes from the book I'm going to bring up. The first one here, he says, is goallessness represents an alternative to an instrumental rationality that insists on seeing all action as a means towards some end or goal. The alternative to instrumental rationality is a more effective sensitivity, less intent on manipulating the world than on appreciating it. So that's obviously a big theme in a lot of my work is, you know, this is what Zen is about. This is all about what exploring our tech philosophy is about, which is focusing less on the over manipulation or imposing our will on the world, and instead receiving it and appreciating it for what it is. The downside of appreciating life for what it is that it can feel really boring because we are used to getting really stimulated and upset. You know, being upset is a type of stimulation. And so when you have that, when you're used to that, we tend to take raw experience for granted. We don't really, you know, we can't appreciate it because we can't feel it. We can't see it. We can't taste it. We have become numb to it. And he has a brilliant quote in here about how we rely on media to interpret our raw experience for us because we need that ideological twist and turn in order for it to actually get picked up on our super like exploited radar. Meaning like you have, most of us, because we've been exposed to so much stimulant technology and things like this, it takes a little extra oomph for something to go beep beep on your radar stimuli, your receptors, your eyes, your ears. And so media is what, you know, he I love how he phrased how media is how we get to twist the raw experience into something that now you want to look at it. You know, it's almost like, you know, maybe raw experience is just like a piece of marble, but the media gets to kind of sculpt it. And because they sculpt it, you can now identify it. Say they sculpt it into like a face, the body is better at reading patterns and will see faces in places they're not. And so the media helps you see something which otherwise to your radar would not be picked up. So the other quote he has here, which I love, he says, the media insists on mediating censorship for family viewing and a spin on the news to add interpretation and meaning. The downside of raw experience is that it's meaningless. That's what I was just saying. Take away the mediation and you take away the meaning. So again, if you don't have the corresponders and the extra, you know, headlines or images or whatever is being used in the sequence it's being used, then would you even care? Like, for example, half of the celebrity gossip that's going on, like, unless someone was able to compile it into an interface in which you saw the headline and the picture and the description, if no one was there putting that together, would you even know it happened and would you even care, right? So that's the whole thing is again, media is curating your raw experience and it comes at the cost of you neglecting the raw experience. I'm not anti-media, clearly. I'm just, you know, I'm all about like, understanding what exactly is it doing for us and at what cost, right? So, and again, what the media will gravitate towards, especially because we're in an attention economy, is obviously drama, contrast, conflict. And you know me, I don't see conflict as 100% a bad thing. Conflict and the contrast of opposites is a natural pattern in life that captivates us and in many ways does make life worth living. And what I mean is that it's a pattern, conflict, again, the contrast of opposites, yin-yang, right? That is a pattern that plays out on every scale of molecular activity from the atoms in our bodies to the bodies of people who get in conflict with each other, to the planets and the meteors and all the stuff in space that get in conflict. You know, depending on how you look at it, the entire start of existence started as conflict, right? The Big Bang. It is when opposites collide that life happens and that activity or stimuli happens. Even you becoming alive, right? It's a collision between an egg and a sperm. So the attraction for the conflict is seen in our individual lives, but it's also seen in the global economy. And I've talked about that a lot. you know, who's the biggest company out there? Who are the biggest companies? Pay attention, y'all. Right? When you look at something like Disney, what makes Disney so special, right? First of all, they tell fairy tales, right? Which is, storytelling is about conflict. You can't have a story without conflict. But not only that, the amusement parks has, you know, that's something that has to come into the equation when we have these conversations. Because have you ever really thought about what an amusement park is? It is a place you go to experience ups and downs. That is what a roller coaster is. I've often talked about how roller coasters probably top maybe three favorite pieces of technology and has very fascinating history. The whole point, the whole anatomy of the roller coaster is to play on your physiological and emotional desire to experience chaos, but in a way in which is not entirely threatening your life, but simulates it, right? Like when you get to the top, it's really scary and you're like, oh my God, like hope this thing is strapped in, because if not, this is the end. But think about how this is a multi-billion dollar industry. All the major media companies don't just have shows, they have amusement parks, places where you literally go to attach your bodies to scary machines that are designed to make you feel the euphoria of the exploration of the contrast of opposites, up and down. What does the roller coaster do, y'all? It goes up and down. It also goes in what? Circles. Those are the best ones. So keep that in mind when we're talking about the meaning of life and conflict and drama. And again, I've already talked about like ESPN, you know, and as you know, Disney bought ESPN. They're all part of this channel, the Disney Plus, I mean. And guess what else is on there? Marvel. Marvel's a whole universe about superheroes and that, again, conflict, storytelling, drama. So just, it's not just happening to your atoms on a molecular level. It's happening even in our daily lives, in the way we spend our money and what we spend our time doing. So yes. So he talks about how his search for meaning was so based, I'm talking back to James Ogilvy now, the author of this book, was so based in Western academic and scientific thought that he was blind to the inner workings of romance and warmth in the parts of life that are not measurable. And, you know, this obviously was something that was striking out when he was looking for love, and he approached love with logical thinking. And one of my favorite quotes that he says is, "It came to a shock to me that even after I had mastered Schrödinger's wave equation, I still had problems with my love life. I didn't understand that my newfound ability to predict the position of a subatomic particle counted for nothing when it came to predicting the behavior of students at Bennington College, his college, just up the road in Vermont. I would have gotten closer to my romantic goal with a bouquet of flowers, but I was blind to the utility of such apparently useless blossoms." Oh. So this is so many of us right now. We're too book smart. We're too ideologically possessed. We, you know, wouldn't know real love or compassion if it hit us over the head. And what he's saying is, because he was so focused on the utility of things, he didn't understand what flowers, you know, he probably would be flabbergasted at the whole flower industry. Because if you don't understand romance, and not just like sexual partners, but just romance in life, just the warmth of positive mystery. That's the way I define romance. You're going to be flabbergasted at this idea that people grow flowers and cut them and ship them off to retailers to be sold. And they die in like 7 days, and like they're not meant to be eaten or any of that. They are just meant to be enjoyed. And for someone who is super utility focused, scientifically focused, who is coming from this perspective that everything must have an end, every meaning must have an end, everything must have a purpose, then you're gonna suck at attracting women because most of us, the whole point, again, what can kind of make you feel special about getting flowers is that it's just to have a experience of beauty and to feel appreciated. That it unfortunately doesn't get counted for anything in the eyes of a lot of academic and scientific perspective, because it's not directly correlated, or at least to me, I would say it's not directly correlated to survival, but I didn't finish that sentence because I see the correlation. They don't see the correlation, right? They think, oh, well, because it doesn't, you know, ultimately have to deal with, you know, survival, you know, in their eyes, you can survive without that. But in my eyes, and if you look around, we cannot survive without the meaning of life, y'all. Like, okay, we can argue that, yes, you can, like, physically be alive. Okay. But when you have young people, you are producing a culture in which young people are harming themselves, are unfortunately, you know, committing suicide at rates we haven't seen before. You cannot tell me, and that's just the young people. Trust me, it's happening with older people too. Meaning counts for something, okay? Just because it's not showing up on your radar, you know what I mean? And that was why, again, when you hear me talk about the homemaking, like, how is it that this does not get factored into survival? The first, like, sign of survival is shelter. Okay, we have pretty nice houses now. We're not in caveman stages. But the fundamental structure of the home was the first thing that made us into human beings. And not, you know, it's what separated us from the, you know, the rest of the, I guess you can say, the animal kingdom and the way that we see ourselves separated. But you get what I'm saying? And anyway, other animals make themselves shelter too. But that's not my point. My point is that that is survival. That is survival. You know what I mean? Love and care and all that stuff. You do need that. Okay? When you don't have that, you create sociopaths and psychopaths and narcissistic people. And they climb up the ladder. They get into leadership. And then the next thing you know, most of the corporations are being ran by these people who have had a lack of these very basic human needs. They are needs. Okay. So, that is something that a lot of us are dealing with right now, as far as just like we haven't built that sensitivity towards romance. And that's why something like Southern hospitality will hit many of us right in our bones, because you realize that being a decent human being has nothing to deal with how educated you are or how, you know, whatever fancy status you have, but it really has to deal with how in tune you are with yourself and the world around you. As a Yankee girl, you know, Brooklyn all day, every time I go to the South, I am like, I can't believe, you know, that you can have such warm small talk with people, just like, you know, going to get a coffee or going to a restaurant. There is a warmth in the voices of people, generally speaking. I know there's everyone in the South is not an angel, trust me, I'm aware, but you know what I mean, just my experiences being a Brooklyn girl going down there and being like, oh my god, kindness, I forgot how much that does to the soul. You feel the kindness, you eat the kindness. It's in the food, it's in the air, it's everywhere. It's great. And so, yeah, you gotta be in tune with that if you're trying to feel some love in your life. All right, the other quote I have here is, and it's related. He says, taking art and aesthetic judgment as the paradigm for composing a life, we would do well to question the usefulness of utility. How useful is utility? Oh, just hit me in my meta bones. That's my meta spot. I didn't finish the sentence completely. We would do well to question the usefulness of utility as the measure of value. That's all I'm saying. Utilitarianism is the morality of industrialists. By basing morality on quantitative calculations of the greatest good for the greatest number, utilitarians leave morality up to the engineers. You know I love me some engineers, but what he's saying here is that the stuff that can't be calculated shouldn't be measured. Like, we're trying to measure stuff that can't be measured. And not only that, we think that unless something can be measured, it's not important. Well, if I can't measure it, then it must not be important. That is an industrial mindset. That is an engineer mindset. That is a scientific mindset, because they're in the realm of matrix calculation, right? They need grids. They need to measure. Okay, well, what happens when all that falls from, like, what happens when certain things can't fit? Well, then they get forgotten. Then the lost, it then becomes a lost art. Another interesting point is, if you notice that once we got rid of sacred belief systems on a mainstream level, a lot of morale went out the window. Now, I understand the controversy behind sacred belief systems, and I'm not saying, like, oh, we should all just go back to, you know, to that. No, I'm not saying that. I'm saying that sacred belief systems are beliefs in things that are special and sacred, whether they be religious or not, gives moral space for us to actually, again, like, it gives space for us to have those things that can't be measured. That was the point of having sacred belief systems be so much in the forefront. Well, it wasn't the point for everybody. For some people, it was to control others, which I understand. It's not black or white here. I understand we're dealing with the nuanced situation, but the point is that what happened is America invested so much and took so much pride, and Western ideology took so much pride in saying, well, we don't need ideas like God and sacred things to understand life, because science provides us the opportunity to explain things, right? Whereas before, people were using religion for that, and they realized they didn't need God, you know, they didn't need the idea of God to understand things or explain things. And so they were like, we're good. Like, literally, they dropped it. And it wasn't just quote unquote God that got dropped. It was everything that quote unquote God brought, which again is all the immeasurables, the romance, the warmth, hospitality, kindness, compassion, right? Like, we focus so much on utility as the measure of value, and boom, that is called toxic tech philosophy. So we invested in making our lives longer, but we forgot about why it would be important to make these longer lives worth living. We forgot there is a point to making life sustainably enjoyable. And I say sustainably enjoyable because we did figure out how to make life enjoyable, okay? In the sense that we took it overboard. It is now, we know how to create pleasure, obviously, but it is not a sustainable level of pleasure. it can't sustain itself in the sense that when you shoot your nervous systems, when your nerves are shot, is what I'm trying to say, it is harder to lose their longevity. You know, these things need to last you a lifetime. And again, the irony is that we've made life longer, even though it did shorten by a year. I mentioned that in my last episode. The current life span is now shorter by a year. But nevertheless, you know, circles. We're going in circles, y'all. We're going in circles. We need it to last a few more circles. It's not, oh, how do I make this one circle this shit? Well, I don't want just one circle to be the shit. I want to have really good different circles. You know? That seems to be the pattern here. That seems to be the Li here. The Li is a ancient Chinese term for the natural grain in things. I have a podcast about it where I talk about the nature of things. When we respect the nature of things, we can bring out the highest harmony it is capable of. That is when the flower blooms. That is when we get to see your highest potential. What particular Li or molecular makeup you have will now blossom and it will now flourish, right? It's not about forcing it out. It's not about wishing it was something else. It's not about, you know, getting it to come out faster than it was supposed to. You don't want to force a flower to bloom. Just look around. You need a lesson. You need a philosophy lesson. Go outside and pick a flower before it blossoms and tell me what it does. Tell me if it opens up for you. Or tell me if it dies because it got cut off from its life source. In a lot of ways, I feel like we got cut off from our life source when we decided to make our lives about these big goals that are very vague and burden ourselves and make us lose sight and lose sensitivity to what makes everyday life meaningful. Everyday life, not the one special day. A lot of people living for that one special day. Oh, the one special day I get that trophy. But you have every day. Every day. How do you create a life where every day is nice? Not like perfect, you know, but everyday ordinary. I shouldn't say nice. Enough. You know, how can you make it so every day is enough? And that's my whole thing. This is why I see all of this change and negative influence and perception of isolation. It comes greatly from, and it's revealed through, the design of our technology. And it begets itself. Oh, one of the good lines he has in here is, we create the building and then the building creates us. Wow. You know, I read that and I thought about the projects. We create the building and then the building creates us, right? Think about that. That's all, like, that's really what I've, that's a great encompassing sentence of everything I try to talk about. You create something, but that thing will create you too. So depending on what mindset you have when creating the thing, whatever mindset that is will influence how it, you know, comes out the other end, or who comes out the other end. So, I want to thank James Ogilvy for writing this book. It's weird, you know, I, if you want to read it, great, you know, it's obviously in my Amazon bookstore. But I'm just letting you know, you might not really enjoy it unless, like, you can kind of keep up with the, like, abstract language. But it was just so refreshing, and this is my speed. Living life without a goal, with a big G, takes the pressure off, helps you see the beauty in everyday, ordinary life. And that's really enough. That's really, really enough. I also definitely want to expand a little bit more on another episode about these dreams that we have, these big G goals, because, you know, I realized that we don't really need, well, the question that came to me is like, do our dreams need to be realized to be enjoyed? Meaning that, or are they that enjoyable because they are a dream and the merit of their feeling isn't staying that? Right? So what that means is that some experiences keep their integrity when they remain in the realm or medium of imagination than they would be if they were forced into reality. Your imagination is a gift, right? And a lot of us, again, in Western culture, we feel like, oh, I imagined it. I have to birth it. But there are some things, and we all know this because we've all experienced, that having your dream or having a fantasy or having a vivid imagination, it is best, the integrity of that is best kept in the realm of imagination. Meaning that when you try to get it to life, and it wasn't never supposed to be in real life, you realize, in real life, this ain't really shit. And I know that happens a lot in romantic relationships. People get really tempted. Oh, their mind goes off. And, oh, I just want it to be like this. And then you hang out with them. It ain't nothing like that. And you're like, man, I was having a better time just thinking about this, right? So there are certain, like, reasons to question. For some reason, I have my Google Chrome on my TV and it's like playing different screensavers, and the one it just showed is like a bunch of highways, and like under the highways there's trees, and it just is like, this is beauty. It's supposed to be beauty. Okay, sorry. Yeah, some dreams, like the lee of a dream, let's put it this way, the lee of a dream is that it's a dream. And that it's in your imagination. Now, I obviously don't think all dreams are supposed to stay dreams and you're not supposed to, like, make your dreams come to reality. I think, yeah, there definitely are some. But then I think we think every dream has to be a reality. Every dream has to, everything we imagine has to come to life. That's such an American thing. What if its potency is in the fact that it is in your imagination? And that's where you get to draw from its power. That's where its highest expression and harmony blossoms, is in your imagination. I don't know, just something to think about. We'll talk about that another day, possibly. Thank you for tuning in. I really appreciate you guys. I've been feeling so bonded. I love this, you know, way of staying in contact with you and having this dialogue on social media about these topics. Yeah, I really appreciate you. And I hope that you enjoy living your life with or without a goal. All right, bye. Thank you for listening to the Alex Wolf Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave a review. And if you aren't already, make sure you're subscribed to this podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcast. For more resources on innovation, economics, and culture, visit alexwolf.co/newsletter and sign up for my email list. Thanks.